Hello, and welcome to Prose, Poetry, and Purpose, where authors from around the world share how they hope to inspire fellow writers and readers to believe in themselves and others every Tuesday at 1 p.m. on KVSH 101.9 FM and every day at marchtwisdale.com as a podcast. I'm your host, March Twisdale, and I thank you for joining us today. All right. So, Julie, we are here. We are in the interview. How are you today?
I'm so good. Thank you for having me.
And you are in Texas?
I am. I'm in North Texas in the DFW area.
Wow. Weather must be super different between us right now.
We are in the height of tornado season right now, which is why I like to write romantic comedy. It's a little more lighthearted.
So is that a rom-com?
I think so.
Because I hear rom-com being thrown around, and it feels like I've been trying to really pin down that genre, and then you just mentioned romantic comedy. I was like, well, that's what I assume people meant by rom-com. Do you agree?
Mm-hmm. Okay. It is. Yeah, that's what rom-com means, is romantic comedy.
Okay, got it. Ironically, even though your books have a beautiful sense of humor to them, they don't strike me as like comedy first.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. That's interesting because it's like there's some books where it's like it just feels like someone's making jokes constantly. But your characters, I really take them seriously. I feel like they are these full, authentic people who I could have as a friend next door. Or I mean, I really, really love how complete you've managed to pull off these characters, especially characters in the same city over a 3-book series. You get to add to them each time. I'm really enjoying it.
Well, I'm glad. Yeah. You know, I think that there's nothing more hilarious than the state of human beings at times. Uh-huh. So I think that tapping into those really authentic things can be a little tragic, a little funny, and, you know, a little revealing. So I like to think of my sweet spot as sort of like a really, like, very realistic romantic comedy, I guess.
Well, and relatable.
Yeah.
I mean, for me growing up, I moved a ton. I think by the time I was 18, I'd lived in 26 different houses. And mm-hmm. I was always the new kid at school. I moved in the middle of the school year more times than I want to count. And it was the books, you know, that I took with me. My most treasured possession from one house to the next would be the books that I could turn to when I came home from a lousy day at school, or, you know, when I thought, you know, some kids were going to like me, and suddenly, literally, I have known so many mean girl cliques who were just looking around for who it is that they can go ahead and scapegoat in the classroom or whatever, and usually it was me. And I would just go home, I could just sit down and read my book for the 9th time or whatever, and spend time with that character and just feel, you know, safe. And so I imagine you have moved into, you've brought in characters that seem to get maybe missed or ignored in a lot of books. And I hope that it's having a really positive, affirming effect.
I hope so too. I think that seeing, you know, in children's literature, we talk a lot about mirrors and windows. And it's a really powerful thing to read a book and for it to be a window into someone else's life, and for you to get the opportunity to see how someone else lives, and for a different type of person to be really humanized to you through a book. Mm-hmm. But it's also a really, really powerful thing for a book to be a mirror for you, and for you to see that your life is a story that's worth telling, and that you are capable and can have and do all the things that, like, the aspirational romantic lead can have, or the lead of an adventure novel or something like that. Mm-hmm. So it's something that we talk about and we're very aware of in our industry. So it's definitely, for me, it's definitely something that's by design.
Yeah. And you referenced yourself, you said children's literature, and I'm noticing that a lot of people who do specialize in children's lit go all the way up through YA. So mm-hmm. do you see yourself as a YA writer, or children's lit, or like, what are your goals? Because you also, you have the books you've written, but you have the books you're going to write. Where are you planning to go?
I really feel like I would like some of the stories that I write to be limitless. I would like to have sort of a hand in every pot. This is unannounced yet, so I can't really say much more about it, but I'm working on a picture book right now. And I'm also, I've got books for the middle grade age, so like, you know, upper elementary school and middle school. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, the huge chunk of my books that I've published thus far are for young adults, so for teens and for, you know, kids right out of high school. But I'll be honest and say that most of my adults, or most of my readership is adult, regardless of the age that I'm writing for. And I think it's because we all really love revisiting that coming of age time in our lives.
Mm-hmm.
But I also have an adult book coming out later this year, and I have plans to write more adult books. So I would love for one day when I'm an old lady, mm-hmm. for there to be someone out there who sort of grew up with my books and who sort of went from reading me at a very young age to, you know, through adulthood. That's like, you know, the big long-term lifelong goal, is that I was able to sort of like walk with someone, as an author that they, you know, enjoyed and found comfort in. But for right now, I'm just trying to, you know, keep my eyes on my current deadlines.
Yeah, no, of course. Absolutely. That's so great. That's so awesome. I mean, thank you. I think there's this fog, you know, this veil that lies between readers and writers in a way where it's sort of like with even, you know, actors, where you're like, oh, well, I've seen how they are in the movies, but I know nothing about their real life. And a lot of times it's really nice to actually hear what the thoughts are that are going on the other side of that veil. And every writer, when I ask them that question, they have a different answer. So it's always interesting. I'm never expecting a pat answer. So I love that. That was great. Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks for asking.
Yeah. So I want to make sure people know that it's so interesting. When I grew up, very few books had been turned into movies. And so if you're interested in a book, you read the book. And now it's even like Harry Potter. I think initially you had a lot of people, children, whatever, who were reading the books. But then you have this thing that happened where all these books started getting turned very quickly into movies. And now a lot of people just hear about the book and then watch the movie. Have you noticed that there's that growing trend of people who are like, oh, yeah, well, I saw that. I saw the movie. I didn't read the book.
Yeah.
Right? So,
yeah, it's pretty interesting. I'm trying and failing and trying and slightly succeeding at, you know, playing around on TikTok and making little videos about, you know, my books or my experience as a writer, things like that. And one of the videos I made went, I hesitate to call it viral, but it got like a couple hundred thousand views or something like that.
Nice.
And it was about my books and, you know, how they're related to this movie. And I'm always surprised by how many people are like, I had no idea it was a book. I have to go out and read all of these right now. I had no idea these are based off a book. I'm so excited. There's more story for me to discover.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, it's funny because when you're watching the movie, for me, Dumplin, it's right there. It says right there in the opening credits, like based on the novels by Julie Murphy.
Right.
And so it's a thing that our brains very easily skip over. But then at the same time, the movie really helped widen my readership.
Mm-hmm.
But there will always just be people who are just, you know, viewers and not readers, and that's fine. There's no judgment in that.
And then there's audiobooks.
However you...
Right? People who are like, however, I just want to listen.
Yeah, and listening to audiobooks is reading. I, you know, I'm a former librarian, and I firmly believe that listening to audiobooks is definitely reading. So I don't know. I think that some authors probably feel a little bit cranky about it, about you know, their books sort of being like skipped over. But I think that the readers who are going to genuinely want to read a book will discover it. And thankfully there was a lot of good PR around the time that the movie released, linking me to the project and I also think it really has to do with the people who you're working with and, you know, your production team and how much they're keeping you involved and how much they want to make you part of the process of promoting the movie.
Right. That was exactly where I was going with that is I wanted to know what, like, I have a sense that authors are more or less involved. Like, I think Leigh Bardugo right now was super involved in the Shadow and Bone series going through Netflix. But I have another friend who's this amazing published author with just, we're talking dozens of books. And I was like, oh, I'm noticing some of your books are showing up as audiobooks now. You're making the transition over. And she's like, no, the publisher decided to do it. I had no voice in the decision, no choice about who would portray the characters or anything. So I was totally curious to know how engaged you were in the making of Dumplin'.
Well, you know, audiobooks and movies are a vastly different process.
Mm-hmm.
So for your friend that's seeing audiobooks coming up, that's an arm of publishing. So when your book is first bought by your publisher, the publisher has the option of also buying the audio rights. And
right.
if your friend doesn't have any say in it, it could be because the publisher bought the audio rights and is now starting to license that or starting to produce those audiobooks.
Yeah.
So it's a possible thing. It's a good thing, but it is nice to be involved in those decisions as far as like narrators and things like that. And it's just really a case by case process. But as far as like, I'm actually good friends with Lee Bardugo and her, when she first started talking to Netflix, she actually reached out to me and asked me what my experience was like. And, I think the really good thing about Netflix is they're really good at identifying assets.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're really good at looking at something like Dumplin' or something like Shadow and Bone and seeing that there is an established fan base or even Jenny Han's recent series.
The cute
like
one
the
about
I Love You,
letters. Yeah, yeah,
all
yeah,
the
yeah,
boys
yeah.
I've loved before.
Yeah.
Jenny's another friend of mine. And so they're really Netflix and a lot of these streaming services are really good about identifying authors who are assets to the production of the movie and authors who have a relationship with their fan base and their readership. And so I was really lucky to be working with people that were able to identify that and make me part of the process.
Nice. And did you have like, I don't know, was there anything that surprised you about the process or something you want to share about both for my writer listeners who might be imagining, you know, and hoping one day to be in those shoes. And also for us, the viewers, you know, once again, there's that big foggy, you know, veil. We don't really know what's going on back there. Anything you want to share?
Yeah. Well, as far as the movie goes, the film rights were actually originally purchased by Disney for like a big theatrical release type movie. And their priorities at Disney were starting to shift. They were starting to make, you know, properties based off of, or they were starting to make, you know, movies and books and things like that based off of properties they already owned. So, like, all of their iconic princess stories and things like that. And so when my contract with them expired, they had already hired a screenwriter and a bunch of producers. And when that happened, I thought that that was it. I thought that our time and our chance, you know, with making Dumplin' into a movie was done. But it turned out that everyone who was hired for the project was really passionate about staying with the project.
Uh-huh.
And so it was those people that Disney originally hired that helped me make the movie and helped us get Jennifer Aniston and Dolly Parton and all those people involved.
Mm-hmm.
So it was really a project that had many opportunities to fail. And it was sort of, I think it's really easy to see a movie and just assume that like, wow, it's this like straight shot pipeline.
Yeah.
Like, someone saw this book and just and was amazed by it and wanted to make a movie about it. And then it was done and Netflix released it. And really we made the movie independently. We were cutting a lot of corners trying to do this as cheaply and efficiently as we could, but still make a good movie. And eventually, after we were done and we shopped it around, it was Netflix who bought the movie. But it's really easy to just see the big flashy thing and think that that's it. But really, it was like years of struggling to make this happen.
So Netflix didn't actually like take it from baby to, you know, launch. They actually came at you. You guys did that yourself, like a collaborative group of people who are just passionate about the project. That's a beautiful success story.
It is really fantastic. And, you know, I'll always have such a soft spot for the people who I worked with through that process, because they truly believed in this. I mean, one of the reasons that this movie was made was because Jennifer Aniston was really behind it and really believed in it. And so that's an amazing, incredible thing. And so it was really a passion project for, you know, everyone behind the scenes and her. And so it was really amazing. I think that kind of thing actually happens all the time in publishing in general, even when it doesn't come to movies. You're always finding that, you know, the big books that you think are like super mega hits really were just, you know, based, like they're just sort of like built on like a graveyard of failures.
Right. It's like a garage.
Something happened.
It's like a garage band. I mean, we all get that, you know, the teenagers who are banging around in their garage for like, you know, 7 years, driving the neighbors crazy, and then suddenly poof, they become famous. You know, I mean, it's like we've all sort of heard that story. But I think when it comes to movies, we assume it has to be big budget to begin with. You've got all this tech, you know, and yet really it's just whether we go to the moon or Mars or whatever it is that we do, it's just human intention.
Right.
Manifest.
Yeah. I mean, we had enough money to make that movie in 30 days, and that's what we had to do. And they did it.
Gracious.
Miraculously, they did it. So,
I've done theater, so I have a sense of what it's like, you know, in the background. I know what the green room's like, you know, and so that was really beautiful for me to actually spend a number of years with my kids doing theater and being like, oh, wow. Honestly, the experience of being in a play is like a 1,000 times more than the experience of sitting there with your ticket in your hand and watching it, you know? And it's like, I'm like, oh, all the action was what happened in the back and in the, you know? And so, yeah. Oh my gosh, it's great, especially costuming. I have mad respect for the people who figure out costuming, because I just wear sweats all the time. I am a non-costume brain woman. So, so cool. All righty. Well, let's see here. Thank you for sharing those details. I imagine you were able to actually connect with Jennifer a few times.
Yes. Yeah. We met for the first time on the set, and there was sort of like, before we had a chance to meet, there was sort of like this like passing notes back and forth, sort of like through the production team of like, we're so excited to work with you. I'm so excited to meet you. I can't wait for this to happen.
Yeah.
But I felt like none of us really knew if it was definitely going to happen until the first day we started filming. Right. We kind of were all waiting for something to fall through. And so when I spent some time on set and I got to visit with her, and then, you know, of course, getting to see her through like, you know, all the different publicity things that we did. It's really cool. I couldn't tell you anything bad about her if I knew anything bad about her, but I can tell you that I have seen her work, and I've seen how she can really kind of lead a cast like that, a really young cast like that, through a really galvanizing thing, making a movie in 30 days. And she's really fantastic. She deserves all the good things
that come to her. Yeah. All right. Okay, cool. So I want to dive a little bit sideways into a question about the genre contemporary fiction. Mostly because I really like the opportunity during this show for my audience to just, you know, I've learned so much specifically over the past, I would say the past year. You know, the pandemic for me, eliminated my job, which cleared up space. And then, of course, I couldn't go looking for a job because everyone was on literal lockdown. So, you know, you don't go looking for a job when there's no jobs happening. So I was like, all righty, then I'm going to dive into my garden, which ironically, the previous fall of 2019, we'd actually sort of like had it plowed for the first time in a long time and thrown in a bunch of cover crop, and I was going to let it go fallow for a couple years and just rest. And I was like, well, I'm glad I invested that money last year, because you're going to actually be working garden this year. And, you know, so I like injured. Oh, my goodness. Okay, so everyone out there who's over the age of 40, you know, when you were younger, you'd go out in the garden and you'd start gardening and you'd feel a little sore because you were a little sore, and you'd feel better after a few days. Well, when we get older, our ligaments and tendons lose some of their blood flow and their elasticity. And when you start hurting, actually, like, stop and pay attention, because I didn't. And I ended up injuring, in particular, this one tendon connection between my bicep and my shoulder that still to this day, 11, 12 months later, is still actually causing me some problems, although it's almost healed. So I basically beat myself up doing the gardening thing. And then after that, I just dove into my writing, which I'd always been distracted by with kids and all these other things, my jobs or whatever. And I was like, well, gosh, pandemic has shut down like almost everything, and my kids are finally adulted. And I was like, oh my goodness, I get to really put time into this. So I'm learning so much stuff right now that I haven't known before, and it's thrilling. So I wanted to talk a little bit about the genre of contemporary fiction and have you just chat a little bit about that, because I'm more of a speculative fiction reader with like a background in sci-fi fantasy, and I tend towards supernatural and dystopian elements. And so your books, which are, I believe you said yesterday when we were chatting, are in the contemporary genre. It was like a genre stretching for me, and I'm so thrilled I got stretched. And I was hoping you could maybe explain a little bit about contemporary genre. Maybe what are some of the goals of writers who are writing contemporary fiction? What's the purpose behind it? And just go there a little bit.
Yeah, I think that, so I do mostly write contemporary. I do have two books, well, one of them will be out later this year, that are speculative that I've done in conjunction with a comic book company. They have a plus-size superhero, and they asked me if I would be willing on doing sort of like coming-of-age novelizations about her. And that's been really fun to work on, but like you said, it's really been stretching my brain muscles. Like, it's something totally new for me. I think the funny thing is that as a reader, I really gravitate towards speculative fiction. I've always loved anything with like a little bit of magic to it. Fairy books specifically, I've always loved. But as a writer, I feel really at home in contemporary fiction. And I think that, you know, for authors who are writing contemporary, there's all kinds of different motivations there. I think that a lot of us were sort of jaded by the classics growing up, as I'm sure that you will find with most readers right now. So there's this kind of excitement in contemporary that like we could be writing modern day classics. Like we're writing these little time capsules that are reflections of the exact moment that we're writing them through.
Right.
And that's a really exciting thing, I think.
I love that. Yes, totally. I mean, Pride and Prejudice probably is a great example, and everyone has a sense of she was writing about what was really, she was writing contemporary fiction when she produced those books.
That's exactly the thing. So many of the classics that we value were just contemporary fiction at their time. That's just what they were. So I think that that's really, there's so many fantastic authors who I love who are writing about very specific, important topics right now, like police brutality and things like that. And their books are truly instant classics because they are such an incredible reflection of the current thing that we're living through. I don't know that I would think of my own books in that way, but I do think that that's something really special about contemporary fiction that we don't think about often, especially because in the bubble of publishing, usually the books that get the most money are like the big fantasy books. And so at times, a lot of contemporary books are sort of just like just kind of written off as like a one-off story that will no longer be relevant once the time for its relevance has passed.
Really? Oh my goodness, that's interesting.
Yeah, but that's a big swapping statement. But that's not always the case necessarily.
Yeah, yeah, but I hear what you're saying. Yeah, interesting.
So it's interesting. It's an interesting part of publishing to exist in, and it's one I really love. But there's always like most contemporary books will never bring in the type of attention when they're going out on submission in the publication world as like a giant fantasy book would. But sometimes they really resonate with the readers and they really explode in exciting and unexpected ways, like my friend Angie's book, The Hate U Give.
Right.
Or, you know, my friend Nick's book, Dear Martin, or my friend Becky's book, which was turned into a movie called Love, Simon. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's sort of like, it's a little exciting, but it's also, it can be a little frustrating at times to see the way that people value stories. But yeah.
And, you know, it's interesting because for me, I think what's been so really eye-opening for me about reading your books is, and you, I actually read The Hate U Give. I can't remember if I read it first, because I have this thing where when I can tell that a book has been turned into a movie, usually I go grab the book and read it first and then I watch the movie. Like I put off the movie. Every once in a while, no, almost always I do that. I'm trying to, The Joy Luck Club, because it was a movie and I went to see that and it literally was my favorite movie for I think about 20 years and it's still in my top five. It was just shattering. And then later, you know, Amy Tan's book, I was like, oh, I'm going to go read the book. But one thing that's been great and eye-opening for me with reading your books is that I realized, because like The Hate U Give, for example, and it really intense topic being covered. And what I realized was that I had a tendency to sort of avoid contemporary novels, because I think if I'm wanting to read a book because I want to have a release from maybe the everyday stresses of real life and I want a version of an escape, but I want it to also make me think about things. You know, I want to come out of it with some cool ideas, but I want it to be mostly a relaxing escape. I always felt like contemporary novels were maybe going to be too intense for me. Like I might, they would be angsty or they would make me feel more frustrated, disappointed, worried about the state of society. And your books totally didn't do that to me, but they were mind-blowing at the same time. So thank you for that.
Yeah. Well, thank you. I think that, you know, I say that about, you know, contemporary versus speculative, contemporary versus fantasy, but then at the same time, there's something that fantasy writers have to contend with and that they're not taken seriously all the time. Mm-hmm. If fantasy books and speculative fiction are very rarely seen as like the top award winners or considered literary or anything like that. So mm-hmm. I think on both ends of that spectrum, there's a lot to contend with. And I definitely can see what you mean about like the fear of books like that being too intense or not escapism enough. But I also think that there's, especially in teen and YA lit, there's something really wonderful about getting the opportunity to learn about something like police brutality or having sex for the first time or just like any situation that might be scary or different or new to you. Mm-hmm. Getting the opportunity for a teen or a kid to learn about that experience for the first time in a book and not in real life gives them that chance to sort of explore it mentally and prepare themselves for what that might be like or how they might discuss that topic or you know, how they might be able to frame that situation in their own life.
Yes. But what was that 13? Come on. You know, the lead actress, I think, was from Australia, but it's like the book was actually over a 24-hour period of time, but it's a girl who kills herself. And 13 Reasons Why. That's it. Yeah. Right? I mean, yeah. I mean, deeply, deeply intense. There was a huge reaction to that. Actually, on my island, the schools actually came out with, like, emails all to the parents. And there was all this... that was what was amazing to me, was there was all this real world reaction, pushback, confusion. It was like, holy Toledo. I just sort of stood back and watched it all happen and thought, ah. That was intense.
That was really, really intense to see unfold.
Yeah. A good example, though, of how a fictional story can have such incredible relevancy. I want to talk a little bit about Pumpkin, which hasn't come out yet, right?
Mm-hmm. It comes out on May 25th.
Oh, my goodness gracious. Right around the corner. Are you, like, super excited?
I am super excited. This will be my, oh, gosh, let me see. How many books is this now? This will be my 7th book, and then I'll be releasing my 8th and 9th later this year too. It's a really hectic year. So I'm excited, but I also I've kind of come to this realization that the most exciting part of writing a book isn't releasing it for me. The most exciting part of writing a book for me is writing the book.
Mm-hmm.
When my very first book came out, I went to the bookstore and I expected it to feel like magical and amazing and getting to see my book on the shelves. And it was amazing, but it wasn't like this big light bulb moment I thought I was going to have. I had it built up in my head for so long. And I kind of just slowly realized, oh, there goes my dog. I slowly realized that the exciting part of writing a book for me was getting to actually do that as a living and write a book.
Yeah. Yeah. Of course, of course. Oh my goodness. So it's certainly, you know, it's funny for me, like, you have vacations, and when I would have a vacation planned with, like, you know, the whole family, I had to plan it way in advance because, you know, we've got animals and a garden, and so we have whatever. It just takes a while. So I'd be like, oh, for 4 months, I know that we're going to go see family, or we're going to go do this or that. And I would just be so happy knowing that that was coming. And then, like, we would get on the plane. This happens every time we're on the plane or whatever. We're hitting the car. And suddenly I go, oh. And my husband's like, what? And I'm like, we're 7 days away from this being over. I'm like, I just had 4 months of joy looking forward to it. And now, you know, I've only got 6.5 days of it left. And then it'll be behind me. So it's so funny.
Now here, I thought you were going to say that you were the kind of person that got so excited planning for something, but then as soon as it had to happen, you felt like this sense of dread, because that's how I feel.
Oh.
I always get so excited to plan something, and then, like, I'll plan a whole party, and then when it's time to go to the party, I don't want to go to the party.
It's not the dread. It's bittersweet. I'm like, oh, this is so bittersweet, because it's now the end is beginning to come. Call me crazy. I feel like birthdays are bittersweet too. You know, I'm never going to have my beautiful 4-year-old son ever again. He's gone forever, but I get my 5-year-old son, you know, so I'm just my brain. Maybe it's weird. Whatever.
No, I get it. I totally get it.
Yeah. So I'm not super well educated about the various individual movements for equality that are going on all over the world, not just in our country, but all over the world, as well as our culture. I'm aware of many of them without actually having done really a deep dive into any one specific area. And so I want to ask you to just forgive me if I ask a question that's got an obvious answer or if I say something wrong. But one thing that came up for me when I was specifically starting to look through Pumpkin a little bit was I'm curious if there has been a sort of organic collaboration that's occurred between the queer community and body image communities, that the two are sort of aligning in this effort to change the absolutely unacceptable way in which society has this horrible habit of judging people based upon their physique or other aspects of their body. Do you know if there's been a collaboration, accidental or what?
Yeah, I think that the queer community and the body positive or fat positive communities have always been closely aligned. It's just, I think that always been a place that fat people felt safe and welcome in. That said, there is a lot of fat shaming within the queer community itself, especially among cisgendered men in the queer community. But I mean, you can go as far back as like things like Hairspray and see that like fat women and gay men have constantly found common ground together, mm-hmm. and not only found common ground, but like a place where creativity flourished. Mm-hmm. So I don't think there was ever any like one meeting among like the fats and the gays where we were like, let's get together and make something and do something.
Right.
But I think that like there's like sort of like an alignment of beliefs and thoughts, and you know, so many fat people are queer that it just there's like some higher percentage of fat people are queer or something mm-hmm. like that. But so many people who would feel, I think, who would have a tendency to want to like feel liberated from the shame that society like put on them because what their body might look like, also find that they might be queer, because it's just sort of like a liberal leaning thing in general.
Okay, and so just to follow that a little bit further, you know, so many of us are becoming increasingly aware of, and this is a long list of letters, LGBTQIA, and there may be more coming down the pipeline, but many of us are only peripherally aware of the life issues that people experience when they are not, as you mentioned earlier, cisgendered. And I was wondering if you, and also you mentioned in a lovely letter you have at the beginning of your ARC copy where you're talking to the reader, you refer to yourself as queer, and this is the introduction to Pumpkin. I'm wondering if, before we talk about Pumpkin a little bit, if you could help people understand and grasp sort of what those concepts mean. Well, it's like a huge question. I think you can probably handle that, though. I'm just throwing a giant, giant question your way. But I just want people to be grounded so that they're sort of with us and they're keeping up.
Yeah, so first, cisgendered means that a person's gender identity corresponds with their birth sex. So it means that I was, I was pronounced female at birth, and that birth sex also corresponds with my current gender identity, which is female or she, her. So that's a quick definition of cisgendered. Mm-hmm. As for me personally, I am a bisexual or pansexual woman who is married to a straight guy. So that's how I personally identify as queer. Mm-hmm. But I do think that what's great about all the terminology in these younger generations is they're really good at cataloging all of this information and really making it like readily available. So I think that it's the kind of thing where if you ever have a question, you can just ask, you know, mm-hmm. it's better to ask than to have like a foot and mouth moment, you know? So even if it's like something where you meet someone for the first time and you can't tell what their gender expression might be, it's always okay to just say, do you have specific pronouns you prefer? Mm-hmm. In fact, it's a great thing to say regardless of what kind of gender you might perceive them to be. I don't know if that fully answers the question. But
no, that was brilliant, brilliant, brilliant. I mean, we don't have the 5 days or 5 weeks necessary to go full depth, but we only have another half an hour. But it's interesting. I think a lot of times people, as they, it can happen at any age, but in particular also as you get to a certain age, which I didn't really get this until I actually got to this age. So, you know, I'm 48 and I'm starting to go, oh, I get things that people in their 40s and 50s used to say that I didn't understand. One thing I've noticed is there can be a bit of a hesitancy or a fear that you're not going to be able to learn new information as readily or keep up. And I think that for some people, just the fear that you're going to try to understand and fail is enough to cause you to not actually seek out more information. And then people just either dodge an area that they're not familiar with, or they take whatever their first impression is, which is probably going to be a stereotype, and just sort of like decide to go with that. And so interesting for all the writers out there, and readers, this will be interesting, a little backstory. I have been avoiding learning the difference between active and passive writing for over 10 years. People would mention to me in different writing groups and stuff, oh, well, you know, well, that's passive. And I would, and I was so worried. I'm not a grammar person who loves grammar and things. And I was like, I'm not going to understand it. It's going to be confusing. It'll be really hard. And I've just dodged it. And finally, I think I got a line edit done on the first 10,000 words of my current work in progress. And I just looked up the difference between active and passive. And like, it was 12 minutes later. And I'm like, oh, I totally get that. And I was like, I've spent 10 years avoiding something that took 12 minutes to understand. So yeah, there's so much information out there readily available. Just go on Google and start exploring and you know, get familiar.
Yeah, and if it makes you feel any better, I do it all the time. I've always hated the idea of even like a writing class or anything that prescriptively tells me how to write or what makes good writing, or even like plot beat sheets, things like that. Like,
right.
I just don't like them. I just like to march to the beat of my own drum. If I'm doing it wrong, I don't want to know, because if I'm doing it wrong, I might still feel right. and I think that that's actually one of my biggest pieces of writing advice that, you know, I won't say this curse word on the air because I don't know if I can, but that it's just kind of all bull crap writing advice is. Like, it's just, it doesn't matter how you get to a place as long as you get there.
Mm-hmm.
So however your writing process needs to look is how it should look.
It's like
I think it's fine that you took that long to find out.
Oh gosh. Well, I was laughing at myself, but I also felt so happy and relieved that it wasn't this thing that was going to take me months to try to understand. I was like, oh, and it was so cool. The thing I found online even had like, okay, well, here's some sentences that are all written in passive voice. So now practice shifting them to active. And I was like, boom, 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 boom. I was like, oh, if you should see me, I was jumping up and down in my office squealing. So anyway, so yes. Yeah, so, all right, well, let's dive back into Pumpkin a little bit here, because Pumpkin is so brilliant in that your first, two books in this specific trilogy, I guess it's fair to say they were heavy on female characters. Mm-hmm. Yes, no? And this one's about Waylon. And as a mother of sons, with brilliant joy in my heart about the advancements we're seeing in the civil rights movement right now, the current civil rights movement, the women's, you know, advancement, I'm really, really happy about that. And as a mother of sons, I can see that the harm that's caused to males by our society is not often recognized or spoken about or being tackled. And I think that it was so great that Waylon's here now. So can you talk a little bit? You do a brilliant job of discussing what it is that's going on, especially when it comes to fat shaming for men compared to fat shaming for women and stuff. If you just want to dive into that, I'd love to hear it.
Yeah. Well, I think that, you know, men aren't going anywhere. You know what I mean? So I think that it's really important for us to be really thoughtful about how we raise our boys and how we are broaching all these current topics that men seem to be at the center of and at the core of, especially white men. So that's really important to me. But also, I wrote this book in a way because I was inspired by my spouse, as I am often. And he is a bigger guy. He's a fat guy. And he's always been like the Mr. Fix-It. He's always been kind of like the protector, like burly, bearded guy. In high school, he was in wrestling, he did football, he did all those primarily masculine things that you would suspect someone like him might do. And I noticed early on when I was in high school that fat boys did not get treated the same way as fat girls. If fat boys could make themselves useful, if they could be masculine, if they could be protectors, then their fat or their fatness was sort of seen as like a beneficial thing. Like it just made them bigger. It just made them like more of that type of personality.
Well, like the linebacker, I think, example you gave yesterday. I mean, literally, I don't think you can even be a linebacker unless you're like packing on a lot of extra weight because you're like this boundary or this wall they have to run into, right?
Yeah. Right, exactly. So it's really about serving a purpose. Mm-hmm. And while it may sound like they're just, you know, they're having like this privilege of being, you know, a guy who is fat, yes, there is privilege to that, but also they're being shortchanged just as much as, you know, a lot of other people are, because they're being forced to use this sort of like role of hypermasculinity as like a social currency. Mm-hmm. So my husband was always forgiven for being fat because of all of the masculine things that he could do. Mm-hmm. The thing that I hid behind growing up was humor. If I could be the funniest person in the room, you might forgive me for being fat. Mm-hmm. But Waylon was really born out of this thought of like, what happens when these big burly guys don't bow down to like this idea of masculinity? What happens when they don't conform to that mold? And they're something else entirely. Mm-hmm. And that's where Waylon came from, is this unwillingness to, you know, fit into that mold.
Right. Or to dodge society's judgment by complying with society's expectations.
Right. And not only that unwillingness to, but like for a lot of like these, you know, for a lot of queer people, it's life or death getting to be them true selves. I'm sure that a boy like Waylon would do the football thing. He would do the you know, dad bonding, Mr. Fix-It thing if he could, if it didn't make him feel like he was like dying inside. Mm-hmm. But it really is that dire for some of us.
Right. And so that's, so do you want to not give spoilers, but hints and fun thoughts about Pumpkin for the people who are sitting around waiting for it to actually launch and be available?
Right. So Dumplin', Puddin', and Pumpkin are the three books in the, I guess you could call them the Clover City Trilogy or the Dumplin' Trilogy. And the third, every book focuses on a different character, all set in the same small town. And so Pumpkin is about a boy named Waylon Brewer, who is a huge fan of a very popular drag show on TV. And sort of in this night where he is rejected on multiple levels from a sort of like friends with benefits person, and also from his twin sister, and also just very disappointed with how his favorite show has played out, he decides to film a audition tape for this drag show. And the audition tape is really raw and a little bit crazy. And something that he probably doesn't actually want to get out, but of course it finds its way out into the world and is accidentally leaked to the whole school. And in response to that, he's nominated for prom queen as a joke. And rather than sort of reject that, he decides to run with it. Mm-hmm. And actually run for prom queen. So that was really fun to write, writing in lots of little drag queen moments. I'm a huge fan of drag. I have been for years and years and years. Mm-hmm. I think since like the first time I saw The Little Mermaid as a child and found that the only character I cared about was Ursula. that's when my first obsessions with drag start, I'm sure.
It's what a raw deal. I'm always like, where's the backstory to Ursula? I mean, like, she's not just evil for the sake of evil. You know, I kept waiting, you know, to find out that she'd been treated badly or you know, and nope, Disney just did.
I know. I've got hopes. I've got hopes. They're supposedly making an Ursula movie, so I've got my fingers crossed.
Well, and what was it? Angelina Jolie did that with Maleficent. Gave us the backstory to what was had otherwise been, of course, you know, in if you're a female with power, therefore you're the bad guy.
Right.
Bad gal. Right. Whatever. Yeah.
Yeah.
Old stories being re-envisioned and recreated.
I really love it. I love to see it.
So we only have like just a couple more minutes left. And, you know, primarily in addition to the fact that you're touching upon fabulously important and relevant issues, you are essentially creating stories that capture, hold reader attention, pull us to the seat of our pants, and have characters that we care about, stakes that keep us flipping the pages. I mean, you are writing amazing stories. And from the perspective of craft, and for all my writing listeners that are out there, do you have any favorite books on writing, which ironically you mentioned earlier, you're sort of like almost anti that, but are there tips, are there habits that you've personally cultivated, you know, for the person who says, tell me how you did it, what would you offer up to them as a gem?
So I do have for as much as I don't like writing advice, I do have a little bit of advice that I like to share with others. The first thing that I noticed in my writing career is that the moment I decided that I wanted this to be my life, the moment I decided that I wanted someone to take me seriously, I decided that I was going to start treating writing like a job, even if someone wasn't paying me for it yet. So whatever amount of time I could dedicate to writing, I promised myself that I would dedicate that amount of time to writing. So even if it was 30 minutes a week or 30 minutes a day, I treated it like I was clocking in and out for a job. And I promised myself that time. So I found that once I started investing in myself that way, that's when things really started to shift. And that's when I started to really value my time a little bit more. And it is really true what they say, like a writer writes. So I think that when I was first thinking about writing, I spent so much time just thinking and thinking and thinking. And yes, there is so much we do before we sit down in a chair and actually write that's just completely mental. But it's also important to just sit in a chair and face the blank page and mess up, you know?
Yeah, totally, totally.
Yeah, I mean, that's like, and it's like 50% of my job is just failing over and over again until something feels right. And so I think that that's really important. And the other thing I really like to make writers aware of is the fact that you cannot compare yourself to a finished product. And I still am in danger of doing this. I'm still constantly looking at books coming out and my favorite writers or just books that I'm like enamored by and feeling defeated by them and feeling like I'll never be that good. I can never do anything like that. And then it takes me a moment to realize, like, this book has been through rounds of edits with an editor at a publishing house. And it was probably through rounds of edits before it got there. And I can't, you know, I can't compare my first try to someone else's published work.
Yes.
So that's really, really important to understand, is that the writers who you love and see on shelves have failed just as hugely as you might as well.
No, I once again, that veil, that fog, you know, it's if people could see what, you know, Oklahoma looked like in the first week of them, you know, preparing the production and staging it and everything compared to when you sit down, you know, 3 months later and watch the finished thing, you know, you'd be laughing. But no, the doors are locked. You don't get to come in and see it when it's all gritty and messy and not working yet. Yeah, I know, right? I mean, oh my goodness gracious. That's great. Thank you so much for sharing your time with me and my listeners today. It's been a brilliant interview.
This was so much fun. I had a great time. Thank you.
Voice of Vashon is your island connection to prose, poetry, and purpose, where I hope to offer weekly inspiration and enthusiasm by highlighting the committed and passionate work of writers around the world. I'm your host, Marge Twisdale. And I hope you enjoyed my interview with Julie Murphy, author of many books and the soon-to-be-released final book in the Dumplin' Trilogy, Pumpkin. You can learn more about Julie Murphy's work at imjuliemurphy.com. And all episodes of Prose, Poetry, and Purpose are available as a podcast on my website, marchtwisdale.com.
Aye. Fancy! DY!